thanks for letting me come to your place.
Absolutely.
Here in East Nashville. And tell me a little about what we're seeing and what how you settled in. We've got a room, a living room full of instruments and a sparkly drum set and a, a gold top Les Paul and a Telecaster with stars and stripes. And who signed that?
The great Wayne Kramer.
Oh, I just wrote his name down yesterday. MC5, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Kick out of the jams. he's a favorite here in the house. But Erica has been an MC5 fan for a long, long time, and got to open some shows for him.
Mm-hmm. And was this your first place you landed in East Nashville, Tennessee? Or
this no? was not. No. I lived right around the corner from the original Family Wash on Scott and Greenwood mm-hmm. for a long time, which is not far from here, obviously, at all. Scott's just right there outside the front door. But I lived there for about probably a year and a half and then moved to Cleveland Park and lived there for about the same amount of time and then moved here about a year and a half ago. I would say this is probably my favorite location I've lived in so far, just because it's so close to, I can walk to tons of stuff, which, you know, I really like, especially, I've lived in New York for like 10 years before I moved here to town, and, you know, I had to go from just being able to walk everywhere to like having a car and stuff, so it's nice to be in a neighborhood where, you know, I can just walk over and get a cup of coffee or whatever.
Right. What about work? Tell me, I always love to be able to ask a creative person in their creative space or one of their creative spaces kind of how they conjure the situation where they're ready to be productive and creative.
I kind of agree with Tom Waits's take. You know, it's kind of like you have to set your trap in your mind to write a song. You know, I'll usually come up with a phrase or a lyric or something, and it's just one, but it really sticks, you know, mm-hmm. It's almost like you just kind of keep thinking about that over and over again. And that can last for anywhere from like days to months, really. And then all of a sudden it just kind of like, comes out. I guess it's subconscious or something, maybe.
Do you sing stuff out loud when it's half-baked and
sometimes,
try to see what that sounds like and feels like?
You know, here's what I do sometimes. If I get a riff or something that I really dig or some chords that I really like, I'll put my phone down and turn the recorder on mm-hmm. and I'll mumble. I'm not really singing.
Yeah.
All the words are coming out sometimes, but it's a very, like, it's a strange thing. I guess you're kind of like tapping into what the song sort of feels like before there's any semblance of what it could be about or anything. And then I'll notice sometimes I'll listen back to it and I'll have no idea what I actually said, but it'll sound like something. And I'll write that down. And a lot of times that'll end up being what the lyric is.
Yeah. Isn't that wild? I had that as a kid. I'd mishear a lyric on a record,
right?
But I would imagine it as a phrase that meant something more to me.
And I think that's kind of like my favorite songs. I do that with. I find myself in the song somehow. Like even if it has nothing to do, you know, who knows what the author may have intended. But mm-hmm. in my favorite songs, like I can be in the movie, you know, with the rest of the characters or whatever.
Well, how was your birthday?
Ah,
which is a couple days ago.
Man, it was great. I just kind of sat here, pretty much right where you are, kind of let the cat have his way with me, and it was a great day. It's more rare than I wish it was that I just sort of do nothing. I really remembered how like refreshing and healing it is to just kind of do nothing on my birthday.
I'm a big advocate. in the blank, in a blank head, things fill in. I mean, right.
It's true though, isn't
no,
it?
No question. You got to take time to think.
Quieting the mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, pretty good segue to talk about this record, revisiting something you'd already done. Struck me as funny that this week we've got this news about Taylor Swift re-recording her first albums. And America at large is asking itself, well, what would that be like? Mm. And that's a really good question.
Yeah, isn't it?
One, what's it like to sing songs that came out of a you that was 10 years younger?
Right.
Or that had a production aesthetic that's now moved on?
Sure.
Are you gonna... I don't know, when you heard that news, what did you think? Because I know you like Taylor Swift.
I do. I thought it was cool. I thought it was...
for her, it's a power move, of course.
Of course, yeah. Here's the thing. You know, the music business is unfortunately kind of full of these kind of stories, like Taylor's story about having her catalog purchased by an ex-manager who at one point, you know, even was sort of using other clients to, you know, sort of taunt her it's a very strange business. I think anytime an artist can make a move that is ultimately empowering to other artists, I think that's a very, that's a very valid and sometimes, you know, crucial path to go down, because especially when you're someone who is sort of as much in the spotlight as Taylor Swift is, you know, you can really send a message to other artists that says like, hey, look, there's going to be people that are going to try really hard to take advantage of you and of your, creative work that you've spent your life cultivating. But that doesn't have to be the end of the world, you know, and there's ways even to sort of get around that as an artist without, you know, having to sort of, acknowledge this, terrible thing that somebody did to you. So my hope is that, you know, she'll re-record them and they'll come out and everyone will buy those records too. Taylor strikes me as a very forward-thinking, forward-moving sort of artist. So in that regard, I would always be interested to hear something that she was recording, even if it was songs that I already knew or had already listened to and loved on previous albums.
I think anybody that had been around a recording studio, a remix, the process will be running to hear how somebody with that much power, resources, history, et cetera, would treat those tracks, those songs. What you said was about her championing reminds me of, in a big way, of you at the level of specific artists. And you are probably the biggest enthusiast on behalf of your peers and the artists you love, many of whom are friends of yours and in your community. But you are just a constant flow of check this out, way to go, just uplifting people. It's just very much part of you.
Yeah, I guess, you know, yeah, people do say that. And I can see certainly where that's the case. I feel like I'm one of those guys. I'm kind of like a fan of music, just as much as I have ever been an artist. You know, I mean, for me, I got really obsessed with it at a very young age. I liked the details. You know, I really, mm-hmm. I remember vividly like being like an 8 or 9 year old kid, and I had the tape, this Boys to Men tape called Coolie High Harmony, and like it was fascinating to me, like, you know, looking at the names on the inside of the jacket of the record and, you know, seeing who had worked on the album and like all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I've always been aware that there are, sort of two levels of the music business, you know, and they don't necessarily correlate with talent or, you know, a quality of art or musicianship or what have you. There's sort of this level of artists who've been fortunate in some way to garner a very high level of visibility and attention for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, you know, many, many artists who I think would absolutely, you know, stand up to, you know, that level of visibility because their art and all that is really great. But for whatever reason, it doesn't happen that way. And so it just occurred to me that, you know, maybe it would be interesting to share, you know, things that I was passionate about that, you know, maybe on some level, you know, you know, all the people who would pay attention to anything that I would say on social media or something, like, hopefully wouldn't know this artist already or, you know, in some way, you know, I think maybe Jack White was a little bit of an inspiration there too, because, you know, I love the aesthetic of how he's built his career and where he took it from. You're a fan of the White Stripes to you're a fan of my record label.
Yes.
You know, yes. Which includes me, and these bands that I play in, mm-hmm. but then also includes all these other brilliant artists that, you probably haven't heard of before. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. We both were at a show by Beth Bambara from St. Louis just a week or two ago. I noticed you flagged that a couple times and on Twitter, and I wrote about her, and yes, a great example of somebody, who's got it going on in her hometown of St. Louis, but
for sure.
Who certainly needs the boost everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And for whom it was fun for me and clearly fun for you to go, hey, this is wonderful.
Yeah, I just played her the very first song off of Evergreen on the Buddy and Jim show yesterday.
Oh, great.
Doing a new monthly segment over there with Buddy where we try to expose his radio audience to music that they wouldn't necessarily be hearing on the radio or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And she fit that bill perfectly for me. That's when I hear something like that, that I can't wait to share with people. It's, you know, it's really cool of Buddy and Jim to, you know, provide a little platform on their show to share artists like that. So
fantastic. One more question before we get to the record.
Yeah.
And it's about another artist who's very close to you and who is about to come out with new music and who I'm about to speak with this week. Your great friend, Brian Wright.
Yes.
Watching him as an artist and a songwriter who can do so many things, stripped down acoustic, rock and roll, and then seeing him in his role with you, complimenting what you do, and I hadn't seen such exciting twin guitar, such two players involved in jam, you know, in quite some time. It's very, very exciting, and you guys are like brothers. He's about to come up with a project, and I'm about to listen to it for the first time, probably late tonight. And give folks who have not heard the Brian Wright story yet the quick your version of the Brian Wright story.
You know, this is a guy who just sort of, it was kind of the day I met Brian Wright, it was kind of like the clouds parted or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that might sound kind of silly, but you kind of have to know him. He's sort of a, you know, he's solid. He's as solid as the earth. And
did that happen, by the way, when he was in L.A. and you were in New York based, or after the Nashville? How long back do you guys go?
We had both just moved to town.
I think
this was maybe 2012 or 13, mm-hmm. something like that.
Right.
And 2013, I think it was. And the first time that I ever heard him sing a song, I recognized immediately that he was reminding me of why I loved songs in the first place. You know, there are those writers who have those ways of kind of, you know, creating a piece of music that just sort of feels like it had always been there. And he really does that for me. You know, he's sort of a North Star, you know, you could follow him and you wouldn't get lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also matches you in the sense of creating an energy on stage and a sort of a spectacle, and you know what to look at the, you know, the attention drawing with musicality.
It's an art form.
You both are really good at it.
We both studied the Stooges, you know, we both studied Iggy and the Ashton brothers. I even played with Scott a little bit. But you know, that idea of how to properly embarrass yourself on stage, you know, was something that appealed very much to both of us, like right from the beginning, as soon as we found music, I think.
Properly embarrass yourself. That's cool. So there has to be an element of chance and
I think you got to risk
vulnerability
something.
And risk. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, if you're not doing something that's slightly embarrassing, it's not really rock and roll, you know. And I think that, you know, originally came to be about because, you know, singers were breaking societal conventions at a time where that was just completely unthought of, like Little Richard or somebody right. like that, you know. I mean, the hair, the makeup.
Yeah.
The clothes, the range that he used in his voice yep. for a man, you yep. know, I mean, at that time, that was like earth shattering, I think, for some people, unfortunately. And for the rest of us, it was, you know, the parade was starting.
So Karma for Cheap, reincarnated, which is an important word, a karmic word,
yeah.
a Buddhist word. Hopefully this record will have an even better life and then get born again as something even more right. elevating. Yeah. But no, sort of when did the notion occur to rethink the songs?
You know, the Karma for Cheap record was an interesting process. It was a record that went through a couple different producers. It was a record that went through some real ups and downs during its creation.
No, didn't realize that.
Yeah, it, you know, it's always tricky, I think, when you're, you know, coming out with the marketing for something or whatever, like, how honest should you be?
Yeah.
You know? And I think at the time, the story felt like a lot to share. But it's not really, you know, it's just simple, you know, music business politics and but there were some moments where it was like, wow, are we gonna have to like completely abandon this record? I mean, we turned in mm-hmm. some mixes to our label at one point and they sort of kind of didn't hear from them, you know, which is not, that's not usually a good sign. So there had to be some reconfiguring to take place just on the initial record. And I guess when we got done with it, it had ended up sounding much like our live shows do, you know.
Yeah.
It was a lot about the interaction between my guitar and Brian's guitar and the, you know, the rhythm section and some harmony vocals. But it just sort of, you know, I guess maybe, yes, the Stooges or something. Like, it became this sort of, like, you know, sort of power pop, you know, kind of, like, with little tiny touches of you know, like, raw power or something like that. Like, super fuzzed out, mm-hmm. kind of blown out sounds, which I thought, for a singer-songwriter record, was sort of an interesting juxtaposition. However, it sort of occurred to me one day, like, man, these songs really started, all of them, with me on an acoustic guitar sitting in my bedroom or at my piano. And, you know, there felt like something to that. I think this record and a lot of the Karma for Cheap record, in a lot of ways, you know, I was at a place in my life when I was writing that, that wasn't the healthiest place for me. And I think lyrically, a lot of what I was doing on that album really was writing what my hopes and wishes were for myself to heal and get better. And it's funny how when you're a singer, you know, because these things that you write, you have to go out there and you sing them every night. You're kind of inviting this stuff into your life, whatever you're singing about, you know, because you're sort of communing with it on a daily basis, and you kind of have to believe it to put it across to people, you know, and there's something about, you know, in energy and intent where, you know, you'll sort of unknowingly kind of bring this stuff into your life. So a lot of times you kind of become whatever you're singing about, you know. It's interesting to note, many of Elliott Smith's friends will say, you know, this guy was singing about junkies and stuff, but all those songs that he wrote, he had never even tried heroin or anything like that at that time, you know. And then later on, he became a guy who, you know, struggled with that. So, you know, you kind of have to watch what you say, I think,
there's a more cheerful thread in psychology where if you smile, you actually begin to coax out the chemicals that are associated with happiness, and you can wish fulfill yourself to a better place. And they use this in psychology.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that was sort of unknowingly kind of a little bit of the same idea that I did with these songs.
Did you feel that the lyric had gotten somewhat buried and obscured in all that wonderful swirling music?
Well, you know, I found that that certain songs, okay, like Set You Free, for example, kind of went from being this anthemic, you know, call to sort of like defeat the bad thought patterns in my mind to like this meditation, you know, this meditation really on like, kind of keeping the mind quiet, you know, more so than, and you know, and it was funny, like there were no lyrical changes or whatever, but the musical approach to the song on the Reincarnated record, like, became more like the feeling that singing the song every night kind of gave me. Like, it was really interesting how, you know, that song in particular, like, I never had to figure out how to fake it, you know? Like, I never had to figure out how to sell it. Sometimes, you know, you sing these songs so much, sometimes you have to, like, reconfigure in your mind, like, how to inhabit the song in an authentic way, you know? That song just never failed me, and became this whole other thing. And so then when I was, like, recording it, you know, it was just sort of like, well, you know, I know this is kind of like throwing a lot of the touchstones of the song out the window. There's no guitar riff and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's a very, you know, it's a very healing song, was and is a very healing song for me. So I when we were doing the Reincarnated record, you know, I sort of, you know, was really paying very close attention to, you know, how these songs had changed for me over the course of touring on them and performing them and stuff.
Did you put yourself in a very different studio and recording situation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It was just me and my friend Patrick Damphier and in a little tiny room over in Berry Hill. Mm-hmm. And there was no band. There was nobody else brought in. You know, it was just the two of us sitting there, and Patrick obviously had heard the Karma for Cheap record, you know, so we knew that we had an interesting task before us in terms of, you know, how do we record these songs and make this seem relevant. You know, I think, you know, this is not, this is a 1 year anniversary of a record coming out. It's not like you have 15 years of perspective on it or something like that. But, you know, I think a lot can happen in a year too. And for me, you know, the journey that I've been on with it, you know, it really, you know, these songs did feel, it felt natural to reinvestigate them, only if for the fact that, you know, how I physically felt, you know, 2 years ago when I was writing them and the way that I feel now are almost opposite ends of the spectrum, 180 degrees of each other, kind of.
How about that? All right. I'm glad for that.
Yeah, me too.
I'm real interested in how you handled End of the Day as my favorite musical cut from Karma for Cheap. Such a guitar song.
Yes.
So what did that reveal to you?
You know, that one was really interesting. I had sort of a, I was kind of winging, I had a concept of how it could be redone, but I was kind of winging it basically. And I think I just came into the studio one morning thinking we were going to cut that song that day. And Patrick had come up with a totally different idea for it. And there was this like old kind of upright piano. I think it might've even been like a player piano at one point. I love those kind of pianos, 'cause they always sound like, you know, they should be on like Honky Tonk Woman by the Stones or something. They're just like slightly out of tune in a very pleasing way. Mm-hmm. He had covered the entire inside of the piano with these pieces of felt, like taped them over top of the strings, so that when the hammer was hitting the string, instead of, you know, hitting the this wound metal string or steel string, it was a piece of felt hitting another piece of felt. So it sort of had this beautifully kind of ornate but kind of muted sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
He took it a step further and said, I really like the chord voicings that you play on this on guitar. So instead of just playing it on the piano, even though this piano is already treated and it already kind of sounds interesting, like, why don't we'll record 6 takes of piano, 1 for each guitar string, and we will find the respective note that's in that octave that would be played on the guitar if you were strumming the chords, and we'll make that note the note, and we'll just do it 6 times, 1 note at a time, to find each string. Which also kind of, I thought, was a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
So we did it like that. And then, you know, there's like some, you know, there's some pretty lush vocal stuff going on. But we kept it simple. When I say lush, I just mean sonically, you know, like, you know, kind of reverbed, you know. Again, like very sort of like plaintive and meditative kind of sounds. And a vibraphone.
One of my favorite sounds in the world.
Me too, mm-hmm. Man. There's no guitar on it at all. Which I didn't see coming. But, you know, again, I think...
But a tonality borrowed from the thing a guitar can do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's nice.
It was key. You know, I think doing it that way really made that... kind of tied that conceptually back into something that's probably more specific to me as an artist, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Well, that kind of begs a question that I wrote down that was just abstract about this record is, did you discover that you can be psychedelic with acoustic instruments
totally.
Without those effects and without the electricity?
Totally.
Yeah.
I think... I have a friend who... you know, used to be a big, you know, partier in the New York rock and roll scene, you know, during the time of the Strokes when it was sort of having its revival there in the East Village. And he always tells me, he goes, man, the wildest drug I've ever tried is sobriety. So sometimes, you know, like really clearing all of that stuff out of the way, it kind of creates a new sort of surreal kind of, psychedelic experience, that I don't know that you could really get using, a bunch of effects and dropping acid or whatever, it's kind of, you need to be present to experience the full, weight of what's happening. I think in many ways, those moments are really revealing. It's almost kind of like, well, how psychedelic is this really? Once you strip away all of the, affectation, and just go, what's really here? And how strange is it really? It's pretty strange. I've come to find out.
How did you handle Dream Dreamer, a track that was in its first incarnation, fairly spare?
It's interesting. So I thought a long time about that. And I thought, well, on the record, that one is based around the acoustic guitar and vocal, but it also has all these other kind of swirling, strange elements that are kind of opaque, behind it, that kind of come in and come out over the, course of that song. So maybe you could just do that, just acoustic, or, just a guitar vocal or something, or maybe I'll play it on piano or something like that. And I tried that a couple of times, and, it was fine, but nothing ever felt like it was different or interesting enough to kind of stand up to the original version. So what I ended up doing was, there were a handful of songs that I recorded for Karma for Cheap that I left off the record. And I went and I found one of those that really felt like it fit this specific project, which is a song called My Whole Life Is Over All Over Again.
Right, the video, which you made a video of.
Yes. Yeah. And we sort of, just kind of made the decision of, all right, instead of trying to find a new way to acoustically do this song that's kind of already acoustic to begin with, why not just include a new track that, fits in both lyrically and sonically to this particular project.
Okay.
And sort of lend it, even if you've, completely exhausted your listens on the rest of the songs from the album or whatever, like, at least here's something that you've never heard before, or whatever, that will hopefully draw somebody in, and maybe that would be interesting enough to get them to listen to the rest of it. you kind of have to like give people a reason, I find, nowadays. It's like, if you're selling merch, and you're like the opening band. This is funny. We've had this like happen a number of times where our merch guy will be like, man, everybody kept coming up and going, what's this guy's backstory? Like, before I buy something, like, what's his backstory?
Really?
People really seem to want to have a reason to invest in the music, you know? And so I'm trying to give them any reason I can think of. And in this case, including a new song felt like a good way to...
I gotta respect that question, actually.
Yeah, I do too. Absolutely.
It's not just about the hat.
Yeah, man. Totally. I think anybody that's willing to meet you halfway has their heart in the right place.
Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Craig, for having me. Really appreciate it.